Oregon got a reputation across the country over the years as a place that cares about the environment. It didn't happen overnight, but there is a key period in time to point to. Within a few years, Oregon got public beaches, deposit bottles, a cleaner Willamette River, and a statewide land use planning, and some other things as well, in a series of laws passed by the legislature and generally signed by Governor Tom McCall. Those years are the heart of the span that historian Derek Larson covers in his book, Keeping Oregon Green: Livability, Stewardship, and the Challenges of Growth, 1960 to 1980. It's on Oregon State University Press. Derek Larson is a professor of history and environmental studies at the College of St. Benedict and St. John's University, companion men's and women's colleges in Minnesota. History and the environment and politics frequently travel together in his teaching, and of course the Pacific Northwest, therefore, is a frequent target. Derek Larson, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
I have to believe that the period in this book is one of the richer ones for environmental legislation anywhere at any time.
Oh, that's true without question. So Oregon's not unique in producing a great number of new laws and really an environmental movement at this period, but it is the nation's leader, so that's something to pay particular attention to.
So just as a starting point, why Oregon and why then?
Well, why then is a bigger question that's wrapped up in a national narrative, but the simple issue is that in the period right after World War II, the sort of amassing impacts of our economic development, new technologies, population growth, expansion of our urban centers led to what were really the beginnings of evident environmental decline in the country, right? Declining air quality, declining water quality, loss of green space, sprawl. So there's a national debate beginning in the early 1960s about what the future should look like that starts to revolve around quality of life, rather than the traditional issues of wilderness or parks that conservationists have been tied up in. The public's concerned about quality of life, and that gives rise to an environmental movement.
All right, so this is an important distinction you make in the book. The conservationists were about setting aside some land, having green spaces to play. The environmental movement, a bit more aggressive. And you say it was concurrent with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. Not triggered by it, you think?
I think we could say that they're concurrent and the triggering mechanisms are multiple. Certainly Rachel Carson deserves and generally receives the credit for awakening the popular imagination to the decline of the environment when she publishes Silent Spring in 1962. But in Oregon, the same debate's going on at the same time, and there's a triggering element there with the broadcast of the Pollution in Paradise documentary that Tom McCall produced, which came out literally a few months after Silent Spring was serialized in The New Yorker.
So here again, Tom McCall becomes a really important figure in a number of ways. So 1962, the documentary, 1964, he gets elected Secretary of State, 1966, he gets elected governor. But this documentary that aired on the NBC affiliate in Portland, KGW, let's get back to the actual shape of the Willamette River. I mean, it wasn't quite to the point of, say, the Cuyahoga. I mean, they didn't have fires on it, did they?
Right. The Cuyahoga was famous for catching fire, and it happened not just once, actually, but many times. So there's a long history there of significant industrial pollution, and in that case, oil, right? Oil slicks catching on fire and other chemicals. The Willamette's not that bad. The problem with the Willamette by mid-century, and particularly evident by the 1960s, is declining availability of dissolved oxygen, which is necessary to support aquatic life. And that dissolved oxygen is going down because the available oxygen is being consumed by the amount of waste going into the river, particularly waste from paper mills, right? So the liquid waste from paper mills is consuming oxygen as it decomposes, and then also waste from primarily residential and municipal sewage systems, which weren't generally effectively treated in that period. So there's so much waste going to the river, its breaking down is requiring enough oxygen that the health of the river as a whole is in decline. So it's not on fire, but it's not in great ecological health either, certainly by 1960.
All right. The way that the 60s and the 70s are portrayed now, particularly the Tom McCall era, is when he was in the governor's office and he served two full terms, makes it look like bing, bing, bing. We did all these great things in Oregon at the same time. And yet the quote that comes out of this section of the book is it was not an easy nor a particularly coordinated response to the environmental crisis.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. So one of the things I'm trying to do in the book actually is to expand the context for these moments that we look at as iconic, right? These handfuls of critical legislation, the beach bill, the bottle bill, cleaning the Willamette, which makes the cover of National Geographic as a river saved, right, in the early 70s. those aren't things that just happened at the moment. So the Willamette is probably the best example of that. The Willamette was a mess, particularly downstream, you know, in Portland in the 1920s. And there were citizen efforts to get the legislature to respond and try to address that problem, you know, 30, 40 years before it actually was resolved. So part of the problem here is that it takes a very long time to change the economy, to change regulation, to change people's behaviors, but it also takes a long time to change perception. So the Willamette to most people was a big river, it had fish in it, it was flowing, so it was fine. And even when scientists would say, the quality's maybe going down, it wasn't going down in a way that maybe affected the people that lived along it or in the broader population of the state all that directly, right? Until it started to smell bad, until the salmon were replaced by carp, until there was foam growing on top, and frankly, until, as you suggested, other rivers in the country, like the Cuyahoga, were literally catching on fire and making headlines.
Ah, so it certainly gave people other things to look at and say, you know, we don't want our river to end up like their river.
Absolutely.
All right, so interesting to see that there are a couple of cases in the book where things that were acted upon in the 60s and 70s were actually first brought to people's attention pre-Depression.
Much earlier.
So, yeah, lots of the stuff going on there. But the book is called Keeping Oregon Green, Livability, Stewardship, and the Challenges of Growth, 1960 to 1980. Derek Larson is professor of history and environmental studies at the College of St. Benedict and St. John's University in Minnesota. And he's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is from Oregon State University Press. Big surprise there. We'll come back and talk more with Derek and take some input from you if you have some stories to share about Oregon in the 60s and 70s when it got this reputation as the environmental Eden. Then by all means, give us a call at 800-838-3760 or send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Exchange with Derek Larson and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about a major chunk of the Oregon story today, the period in which environmental legislation was passed in the 60s and 70s to really create the Oregon we know today. Derek Larson, historian and environmental studies professor, joins us to talk about his book on Oregon State University Press, Keeping Oregon Green, Livability, Stewardship, and the Challenges of Growth, 1960 to 1980. Join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. I do want to back up a bit because, as you point out, some of this groundwork was laid pre-Depression. And I want to talk about, for example, the general structure of Oregon society, particularly economically. Give us a sense of how dominant the timber industry was in the early 20th century.
It's really hard to overstate that, actually. Oregon's manufacturing base didn't grow to anything like the size we think of it being today until World War II. So the first half of the century, timber and agriculture were the dominant industries. And, of course, timber is seasonal and also responds to market forces pretty dramatically. So at times when housing is down or demand outside the Northwest is down, the industry would go down. So the economy would kind of wobble back and forth, as you might imagine. And part of the narrative that I'm trying to explore in the book here is the rise of tourism as an important economic force, which really doesn't occur until well after World War II as a significant driver in the economy. And then tourism eventually supplants timber and ultimately comes competitive with agriculture.
One of the figures that really jumps out is not actually from Oregon, but from Washington, where you point out that there was 63% of the wage earners in the state were involved in the timber industry.
Yeah, it's really quite remarkable. And that's part of the region's national reputation, of course, too. Prior to World War II, the rest of the country thought of the Pacific Northwest as being, you know, way off in the middle of nowhere, not many people there, and all of the people were either loggers or somehow, you know, connected to that industry, which, of course, wasn't accurate, but there's a definite perception of that. The Northwest major cities don't have a dominant national role until World War II. There's not a significant military presence in the Pacific Northwest. The populations are relatively low, right? I mean, Oregon's population in 1910 is only about 675,000 people, right? So it pales in comparison to, you know, the larger states, even in the Midwest at that point.
Well, so there were some efforts to preserve some forests by 1920 or so that you point out. How were those received?
They were less controversial, I think, in Oregon than in some other places. So, for example, here in Minnesota around that time, there was a very big fight over the creation of the Superior National Forest up in northern Minnesota, which is where the Boundary Waters Wilderness Area is today, people are probably familiar with. People fought that tooth and nail because they didn't like the idea of that land being placed into reserve. But the early forest reserves and the creation of the national forests in Oregon are a little less controversial because there are fewer people living in those forests. And there's a lot of timberland, both in private hands and under the management of other agencies. So controversial, yes, but you don't get the opposition you do in other places. So because Oregon's relatively low population and the high percentage of federal public lands, it's relatively easy to create those forests. The interesting thing, I think, is that unlike Washington and California, though, Oregon doesn't end up with a large number of national parks, right? Only Crater Lake.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas California and Oregon, or rather California and Washington, are ultimately kind of sprinkled with national parks. So that becomes part of what I wanted to do in the book, kind of set the stage, was exploring this failed attempt to create a national park on the coast as a kind of meter to gauge how interested Oregonians actually were in that sort of preservation work, that traditional conservation. And ultimately, I think the answer was not very in the 1950s.
And that was a pet project of Senator Richard Neuberger, who had made some other warnings about the environment. What was his general line of discussion?
That's right. Neuberger was a really traditional conservationist who believed that public ownership of natural resources would mean a more equitable distribution of them and then ultimately a more efficient use. So he supported national forests, national parks, the management of public grazing lands, and was an advocate in particular for wilderness. So he was a strong supporter for Hell's Canyon, for example. He was opposed to some of the hydroelectric development on the Columbia and wanted Hell's Canyon set aside as wilderness or potentially as a national park. And he was, I think, most importantly, a very proud Oregonian. So he felt, I think personally, that Oregon deserved more national parks in keeping with its neighbor states. So when he set out in the late 1950s as a senator to address that issue, he saw the Oregon Dunes on the Central Coast as the most prominent and most likely place in Oregon to become that second national park.
And what kind of support did he get for it?
Well, it was mixed. So it's really interesting. If you go back through his personal files and his correspondence, he seemed very confident from the outset when he introduced the bill in 1959 that it would happen, that the public would support it, that the rest of the delegation in Washington would support it. Certainly the National Park Service had been talking about it as early as the 1930s. So there was support from the bureaucracy. What he wasn't entirely prepared for was the local opposition. So the proposed park went through a bunch of different permutations, but the largest sort of version of it was well over 100,000 acres, and it would have spanned from basically Florence south to just north of Coos Bay and the spit there on the north side of North Bend. And there was a lot of private property in there and a fair number of private timberland, and there were wells that were being developed for industrial withdrawal of fresh water. And a lot of people just didn't like the idea of the government coming in and managing that in a way that was different from what they were used to. And much of that land was already managed by the Forest Service, but the Forest Service was seen as a resource development partner, not as a preservation agency like the Park Service was.
Derek Larson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Keeping Oregon Green, Livability, Stewardship, and the Challenges of Growth, 1960 to 1980. There's some great stuff. You were talking about tourism and people trying to get Oregon to be more of a tourism destination. There's some great stuff in here about how Oregon tried to appeal to tourists in the late 50s, about the time of the centennial.
Yeah, it's remarkable, right? There's a wholehearted effort by the state, by the what was then the Highway Department, actually had a division of tourism development, and they produced brochures. Certainly, the centennial celebration was a marketing program, right? It was, yes, marking the centennial, but it was also an attempt to raise Oregon's profile nationally as a destination and as a business partner. And the rhetoric that's in that material, particularly the stuff from the state, is just straight up marketing propaganda, right? It's like, it never rains. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly productive place. The people are all friendly. We all make higher than average wages. Bring your family here, because Oregon, after World War II, had seen a pretty big jump in population, during the war. But that population growth slowed in the 1950s. So there were about 500,000 new residents that arrived in the 1940s. And in the 50s, that dropped to about 240,000. So population growth was seen as a sort of driver of economic development, and getting more people to come was a goal. right? So developing tourism, both as a way to bring people in as migrants, but also then to develop that as an economic industry into its own right was a priority, particularly for the highway department, which of course also then could go to the legislature and say, see, we need more money for highways because we've got more people coming.
Well, and you blow my mind, though, because here's a line from then-Governor Hatfield in the Centennial Program in 1959, appealing to people not just to visit Oregon, but to come here and live.
Yeah.
And then so 12 years later, you had the famous line from Governor Tom McCall about, for heaven's sake, don't come here to live.
Yeah, so that's the remarkable turnaround between those two governors, right? We look at a 10-year period, two Republican governors, and the policy changes from, please come, we need growth, growth is our driving factor, to a decade later, we've got to hold off on growth. We don't need population for population's sake. And in fact, we're not even going to embrace all business development unless it follows our environmental values, right? So McCall's message is a very different message than any that had come before, certainly in Oregon and probably in the nation, actually. So he's in a different context, all right? So Governor Hatfield was speaking on the heels of the 1950s when population growth had slowed and the state was lagging behind Oregon and Washington, California in economic development. McCall is speaking in 1970 when the country has become awakened to the environmental crisis and population growth seems to be trending upward again.
All right, let's turn to the subject of pollution, specifically in the Willamette, as documented by Tom McCall 4 years prior to his winning the governor's office as a reporter at KGW. You pointed out that people were talking about problems with the Willamette River decades before, but didn't really deal with it until the carp and the smell began to be really obvious. Even after the documentary, how big or not were the first steps?
Well, it's a big public issue, actually. So it becomes a key issue, actually, in the gubernatorial race in 1966. So when the two candidates and McCall's opponents, Robert Straub, the Democrat who's also known as an environmentalist, they were both campaigning on basically green platforms, saying that, you know, the river is an embarrassment, it needs to be addressed. So the public's engaged, there's support for this. But the interesting thing, I think, is that some of the steps put in place decades before were actually finally starting to pay off a little bit there. And the biggest things, frankly, are changes to the practices of pulp mills, right, which are going to stop introducing as much volume and as much chemically complex waste liquors into the rivers, and the introduction of sewage treatment. Right, septic tanks for individual residences and then municipal sewage treatment plants that reduce the input burden, the nutrient burden on the river. So ultimately, McCall takes and is given credit for cleaning up the river, but in some ways, it's pretty evident once you dig into the archives and start looking at the details, is that he might have given it a big push in terms of public perception, but the actual effect of cleaning the river kind of occurred on his watch as a result of decisions that had been made sometimes decades earlier.
Okay, so he got to be in place in the office when the changes happened, but not necessarily directly because of him.
That's right, and he actually got credit in part for a really dramatic move right after he was took office. The chair of the State Sanitary Commission, which was the forerunner to the Department of Environmental Quality, actually died, and McCall was faced with an open position to appoint someone into, and he appointed himself. Right, so the governor said, I'm going to take over as chair of the Sanitary Commission. So that drew a lot of press, a lot of attention, helped build his reputation as a defender of the river and of environmental quality in general. And in that role, he was able to raise the profile of the State Sanitary Authority. So I think that helped them quite a bit in actually getting traction and moving forward. And it became a pretty clear signal, I think, that particularly to industry, that they weren't going to be able to continue business as usual.
We're talking about that key period in Oregon history where it got its reputation as the environmental state. Derek Larson is our guest. He's a professor of history and environmental studies at a college in Minnesota, two colleges actually, the College of St. Benedict and St. John's University, which are side by side. His book is called Keeping Oregon Green, Livability, Stewardship, and the Challenges of Growth, 1960 to 1980. You might have memories of this time in Oregon history. Let's hear your story. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So that timeline again, when you set it up as you have in this book so succinctly, that it 1962, McCall's documentary on KGW about how filthy the Willamette is. It's called Pollution in Paradise. 1964, 2 years later, he wins election to Secretary of State. 2 years after that, Governor Hatfield decides to run for the U.S. Senate. McCall runs for governor and wins in 1966. But this environmental governor supported a fairly unenvironmental highway plan. What was up with that?
So the Nesteca Spit Highway becomes an interesting story, sort of sub-story here. And it's the one big departure between Governor McCaul and then Governor Stropp, who follows him. There was a plan by the State Highway Department in the 1960s to relocate Highway 101, basically at Pacific City. Or so if you drive that stretch now from sort of, let me think, Hebo, a little south as you're going toward Lincoln City, it's inland, so you can't actually see the surf. It's a lowland, and there's the valley, actually the estuary, the Nesteca there. And they wanted to literally pick up and move the highway onto the sand spit, basically put it on the beach as a way to make that a more scenic drive. And there was really no rationale for it other than, one, building highways, because it's the highway department, and two, is sort of a tourism development access piece. It would have been a beautiful location as long as the spit actually stayed stable. One thing that people that spend any time there knows, that spit sort of comes and goes over the years as sand accretes or is washed out. But in any event, McCaul supported it, and Straub opposed it, and it became a very big issue between the two of them over the years. But ultimately, McCaul's support of the Nesteca Highway seemed to be largely political. He was in some ways politically beholden to the support of significant figures in the Republican Party, including the head of the State Highway Commission.
Glenn Jackson, well-known in Southern Oregon.
Exactly. Yeah, and Jackson supported the project. So McCaul supported the project. And in his private correspondence, it seems that he's not nearly as solidly supportive of it as he was in his public statements.
Did the Nesteca Spit plan turn attention to ownership of the beaches, or were those ultimately separate things?
I think they're coincident, but probably somewhat separate. The thing that triggers the public awareness of the beach issue is very directly the attempts by a few property owners to block off the beach. Right, so there's a motel development in Cannon Beach where the property owner literally stakes off the beach and says, this is our private beach, you can't come here. And, of course, people fought the beaches were public, so they immediately started calling and complaining to whomever they could. They'd call parks, they'd call the highway division, which was responsible for the beaches, they'd call the governor's office. And it turned out that the beaches were, in fact, not necessarily legally public, as people had thought.
Well, the highway division being responsible for the beaches is a fun story, too. And this dates back to Governor Oswald West. I mean, how did he make the beaches public?
Yeah, so that's a remarkable story, too. So if we go all the way back to the 19-teens, this is the height of the progressive conservation movement, right? So in the progressive era, when Oregon is, one of the country's leaders in terms of creating good government and new policies to increase democracy and improve efficiency and root out corruption, among that sort of national movement are voices calling for more public ownership of natural resources. We had the creation of the U.S. Forest Service in 1906, the creation of the National Park Service in 1916, and coincident with that, Governor Oswald West says, boy, the beaches here are very important. They can serve as a highway, at least the wet sands can, so let's make the beaches public. And in fact, in the teens, they pass a law making those beaches public. Trick is, the definitions and the legal case from the 19-teens aren't terribly clear. It wasn't clear to people in the 60s when they started debating this if the public beaches were the wet sand, if they went up to the high tide line, if they went up to the vegetation line, and the pressure, the pushback from property owners were predicated on the argument that all that was reserved for public use was the wet sand, the sand that, you know, that basically got water on it on a daily basis.
So we ended up going into a drier zone than that.
Well, so ultimately, this blows up because the public finds out that, in fact, people are starting to fence off beaches that they thought were public. And I guess the key to understand here is that for generations, Oregonians just accepted and assumed that the beaches were public, that you couldn't block somebody from walking down the beach on the sand, which is, of course, not the case in much of the rest of the country, particularly in the East Coast, where the beaches are mostly private. Oregon had the opposite tradition, and when people challenged that by blocking off beaches or claiming they were private, the public got upset. So this is picked up in the media, and there's a lot of really interesting coverage in the major newspapers from the Valley in particular in the late 1960s when this starts to happen. And people are outraged. There's letters to the editor. There's arguments being shared between legislators about, well, what can we do here ultimately?
Well, Derek, was there any precedent anywhere for Oregon's beach bill?
Precedent in some ways. There are equivalent laws today in Hawaii and Texas. Hawaii's comes after Oregon's. Texas has an Open Beaches Act that predates Oregon's. but it's structured a little bit differently. So it does become actually quite technical, because one of the things you have to think about when we're talking about a public beach is that we're looking at a property right, and these are public property rights that are adjacent to private property generally. And part of the debate had to be, well, where's the line, right? Because we, as we all know, that mean high tide line is different at different times of the year. The vegetation line comes and goes over longer periods of time. And even where the sand is can change as, you know, accretion and depletion occur as natural cycles. So if you're a property owner and one day you have a lot that's an acre, and then 5 years later there's been erosion and now the sand has come farther into your property line, is that now public land? Or conversely, if the edge of my property line, which is in grass, that grass expands onto the beach, do I now own the beach?
All right, so a couple things to think about there about how to build a beach bill in Oregon, which did happen, obviously, and is still in effect today. The book is called Keeping Oregon Green, Livability, Stewardship, and the Challenges of Growth, 1960 to 1980. Beach bill, bottle bill, billboard bill, bike bill, all these things came out at that time. We'll talk more about that period in history with Derek Larson when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange, and we'll take your phone calls and emails as well. We're back in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Derek Larson, Professor of History and Environmental Studies at the College of St. Benedict and St. John's University in Minnesota. He's written a lively book about that period that Oregon is famous for when it passed beach bill, bottle bill, billboard bill, you name it, all sorts of environmental legislation emerged from Oregon right around 1970, which is the center year in the book by Derek Larson called Keeping Oregon Green, Livability, Stewardship, and the Challenges of Growth, 1960 to 1980. You can join this conversation on the Exchange. You may remember those days or have been drawn to Oregon because of those days. 800-838-3760 to join by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Exchange with Derek Larson.
Thank you. Since you're from Minnesota, let me tell you about my experience in the 60s. Dad had a boat in Portland. That's our biggest city. And the river was a mess. So much sewage and like you said, from the paper mills. And then there was so much lumber and stuff, we broke off a propeller on Dad's boat one time running over a power pole. You couldn't even possibly steer a straight line. I am just so glad to live in a progressive state where all that stuff, gosh, I remember, the river is so much cleaner than it used to be. Anyway, that's my comment.
All right, thanks for that, John. Appreciate that. And you are not unfamiliar with Portland, Derek. You spent a lot of time in Oregon doing your research and sometime living here as well, I believe.
Yeah, that's true. I'm actually from Oregon. I grew up in the Willamette Valley and went to college in Portland, you know, 25-plus years ago. So it's been a while since I've lived there, but I came back a lot to work on the book. In fact, the archives that are the heart of the book are in Portland and Salem and Eugene. So I got to spend a lot of time there. I was going to say John's comment is spot on, not only for Portland, but actually for the entire country, because the other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, the national environmental movement is coming into its own in 1969-1970, and we start to see the fruits of that right afterward, right? The Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act. So the federal government is moving at the same time that Oregon is, but on different issues and without the local focus.
You write that the cast of characters for future environmental conflicts was established in the spring of 1967, and these are almost caricatures, and you can tell us if those are caricatures or fair representations, but who were these cast members?
Well, so by that period, we do start to divide up, right? Rachel Carson's book in 1962, you know, brings into the environmental movement, or really maybe even gives birth to the environmental movement in the way that we think of it, by diversifying it. So while conservation had been traditionally been, you know, white male, particularly Eastern-based, political movement, environmentalism, as it arose in the 1960s, was much more concerned with quality of life, right? Issues here, in my yard, in my community, rather than a distant wilderness or something like that. So by the late 1970s, we have many more women, or late 60s rather, many more women involved in the movement who are concerned about their families, concerned about their communities. So it becomes a more grassroots movement. And certainly Earth Day in 1970 draws in even more. So by that point, we started to see this cast of characters we might find familiar, at least in caricatures you suggest. Young people, families concerned about water quality, air quality, green space in their local communities, often portrayed as fighting against big business, right, quote unquote, polluting industries, big factories, the automobile, technology, right? Now, that's really oversimplifying because there are businesses, industries, corporations that are good environmental players in this era and those that are not. And certainly not the whole public was aligned on one side or the other. And I think that's one of the more interesting things about the cases that I'm looking at in the book here is that while the governor is a Republican, he's a liberal Republican, right, which seems odd maybe to younger listeners today. But the environmental leadership from liberal Republicans in Washington and around the country was very important in this era, and certainly in Oregon. But the bills that are coming out of the legislature are often bipartisan, and of course McCall's facing a Democratic majority in the legislature toward the end of his time there, and still is able to produce these consensus pieces of legislation that are nationally significant.
Interesting, you know, that the math at the federal level just isn't there anymore, but the idea of liberal Republicans who would then be able to garner votes from Democrats would be able to form a coalition that would cross party lines.
Absolutely. And part of that is class-based. I mean, that's not a central element of the analysis in the book, but part of what's going on is that traditionally in this era, the Republican elite establishment from the East is in some cases aligning with labor and with the working class, who are represented primarily by Democrats, to secure quality of life issues. So people wanted clean air and clean water in their communities, right? I mean, this is still an issue if you think about Flint. But back then, it was more broadly a problem. And also, you know, positive additions like green space. So we see the National Park Service in the 1960s starting to not just preserve wilderness parks in the middle of nowhere, so to speak, but literally to start to expand recreational areas right in cities or very near to cities. So we get Golden Gate National Recreation Area in San Francisco, Gateway Recreation Area in New York City, the Indiana Dunes just outside of Chicago. Those are places that are intended to provide recreational space, outdoor experience for urban populations.
And, of course, the urban populations have to drive to get to these things, and that's when they notice some things going on the highways, which leads to a whole chapter here about billboards, bottles, and blight. And it's just the issue is not new. I mean, how far back had people been pushing for billboard regulations in Oregon?
Yeah, so billboard regulation goes right back to the origins of our highways. There weren't a lot of billboards in the 19th century, but by the time we had cars in the 20s, there were billboards. And people would be surprised, I think, to understand how many there were and, in fact, how insidious they were, because some of them were actually intentionally deceitful, or someone would put up a billboard for a gas station and someone else would come up and put up a larger billboard for their gas station in front of it, or they would put up a sign that said, you know, next gas station is closed, stop here instead, right? It was just a kind of the Wild West, if you will. Ultimately, the highway advocates, the AAA and similar road user organizations started to argue that these were not only a visual blight, but they were dangerous. People were being misled or could even, you know, not see oncoming traffic because of the billboards. So there's a fight against billboards by the 30s.
Okay, but it took a long time to get the problem addressed in legislation.
Ultimately, yeah, it took a very long time. On the federal level, it's not until the 1960s that we see significant efforts linked to, first, actually in the 50s, I guess, with the Interstate Highway Act, there was an attempt to just ban billboards. If we're going to build these highways, let's not allow billboards. The billboard lobby overcame that pretty easily. In the 1960s, Lady Bird Johnson's highway beautification initiatives in the Great Society programs pushed for removing billboards, and they actually did get funding from Congress to do that, and that's how we ended up with actually today what we're familiar with on the interstates, the green signs that list the oncoming attractions, the blue signs that list hospitals, the brown signs that might list a federal recreation area. Those were all part of that process to take down existing signs and put up a standardized system. But again, the billboard industry, particularly the larger corporations, were able to get the legislation altered in ways that benefited them. So ultimately, the effect was the removal of small billboards and actually an increase in the very, very large billboards that we're kind of accustomed to today. So the federal process didn't really succeed terribly well.
All right, but the state process worked, and to this day, billboards are restricted to commercial and industrial zones. and not out in the broad countryside.
Yeah, Oregon kind of achieved a half measure. So there was an initiative petition on the ballot to really heavily restrict them that was killed by industry opposition. But they saw the writing on the wall, and legislation was finally produced in the mid-60s to restrict billboards somewhat in Oregon. Other states, though, banned them outright, right? So we do have a handful of states that just simply do not allow billboards. Or the other opposite, I guess, example would be here where I live in Minnesota, where there's no regulation, and we have billboards everywhere, including these big digital ones now. So the arguments people made in the 20s about distraction and safety and visual blight are clearly still applicable in much of the United States.
Wow, 90 years later, we're having the same discussion.
Exactly.
Interesting. And beyond billboards, though, I mean, and this is a tough one to get across. When I see young people dropping wrappers and stuff on the street, I think, okay, you were not around in the 60s like I was to see PSA after PSA on TV saying, don't litter, put it in the basket, and ultimately led to the Crying Indian commercial, which I think is still famous today.
Yeah, and that's an iconic commercial for a good reason, right? I mean, it's very, very effective. It's also a very interesting story behind it. So part of what's going on in the early 1970s and when that Keep America Beautiful produced commercial about litter is aired is the industry fighting back against Oregon. Right. So Oregon, because of the efforts of one person, Richard Chambers, just a citizen from the coast, took on the bottling industry in this period in which container production was switching from what maybe some of us will remember as the returnable containers. Right. We used to get beer and soft drinks in glass. Mm-hmm. Those glass containers, once they were used, would be taken back and then washed and reused. That was the intent. In practice, often what happened was people just threw them out the window or into the garbage. Right. Glass containers are heavy. Washing them and reusing them is expensive, so the industry was looking for alternatives, and they started to shift to metal containers in the 1960s, and they actually advertised those as disposable containers as if that was a plus, because then you wouldn't have to pick them up. You wouldn't have to worry about broken glass along the roads. They were convenient for the user. You just toss them in the garbage. Late 1960s, people start to realize, well, one, that's a pretty big use of resources, right? We're taking, you know, mining, refining, smelting metals, and then just throwing them in the garbage after one use. But more importantly, people are starting to see these things along the roadsides. And it turns out that in Oregon in the early 1970s, there are studies that find as much as 80% of all roadside litter was beverage containers.
Wow, that's a bunch. And so ultimately, we ended up with a nickel deposit in Oregon.
Yeah, and the deposit is new, right? No one had done that in the United States. In British Columbia, there were a couple of municipal deposit laws, and that's where the inspiration came from. But Oregon took on the bottling industry and fought a pretty hard battle, actually, to get a deposit put in place, which is a burden on the retailers that have to deal with the system of returns, and it's a burden on the producers who have a more expensive process to work with. But it was very effective. I mean, as the proponents said, it would, one, prevent people or at least incentivize people not to throw containers out the car window, and two, it would incentivize people to pick them up if they did. And certainly, you know, as a teen growing up in Oregon in the 70s, if I needed a buck or two, I'd go out and walk down the road and pick up some bottles or cans and take them to the store.
We're talking to Derek Larson about his book, Keeping Oregon Green. Here's a call from Greg in Murphy. Welcome to The Exchange.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to call and say I moved here from Arizona going on 40 years ago because there was so much growth and pro-growth down there in Tucson area that there were just miles and miles of some of the most beautiful desert in the world that was just leveled and destroyed, and the cities and counties left no greenways or parks. It was in it's a mess. But aside from that, my brother-in-law has made over 100 trips to China. He set up one of the first computer factories over there, and he was telling me about a town of what he called a small city of 4 million people in China, where they were producing solar panels that competed with Solyndra, if you remember them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the town was so polluted that the people that had it, and one day there were 50,000 people took to the streets, and Roy described it. He said that within an hour there were tanks and armored personnel carriers surrounding the protest, and the people were ushered away. But I'm just concerned with the new administration that says that this is manufactured by China, all the efforts to clean the air and water now, and you know, that really frightens me.
All right. Thanks for the call, Greg. Appreciate that. I want to come back to the original part, though, where he moved to Arizona from Oregon. In fact, that gets us into the discussion of the limits of growth. A lot of people moved to Oregon because things were nice, and it brought some wrath down on Californians, didn't it?
Absolutely. So a big part of what's going on with the passage of land use zoning and the concerns over growth in the early 70s are exactly that. Oregon developed later than Washington and California. It grew slower than Washington and California. It had more green space, more perceived amenities, better quality of life. So as McCall took that banner up and started to promote it, of course, it attracted people. So population growth increases. In the 1970s, in the decade, 500,000 more people move into the state, almost double the rate of the 1960s. So McCall famously says on, you know, on national television, sort of an offhanded quip, Oregon is a beautiful place, but, you know, please come here to visit, but don't stay. Right? He's concerned about, personally, the impact of people coming in from other places to live in Oregon. Now, that doesn't make a lot of sense if you imagine those people being motivated as potentially positive environmental actors wanting to come and make the place better. These might be, in some ways, better residents than the ones who were already there polluting it. But the numbers of people coming in both as new migrants and then also just as visitors become key to this issue of growth in the 1970s. And for McCall, the solution is land use planning, to have a planned, you know, set in place so that as this inexorable growth occurs, we don't lose our green space, we don't lose our farmland, we don't lose our quality of life.
You contain it. You keep the resource lands as resource lands. Has any and believe me, as you well know, it's still controversial in Oregon among people who want to use their land. We've had Measure 37 and Measure 49 to make some amendments to it. Has any state come close to what Oregon has done with what became Senate Bill 100?
Oregon certainly is the national leader in this. So they've not come close, but Hawaii in particular has done impressive things, and other states have done things or municipalities that work similarly.
One of many things rolled into what you refer to as Oregon's greener than thou image. There's a lot of great stuff in this book, and a lot of interesting things happen in Oregon in this time period. Keeping Oregon Green, Livability, Stewardship, and the Challenges of Growth, 1960 to 1980. Derek Larson wrote it and joined us today. Derek, thanks a lot.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
All right. Take care.